Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for listening. Lost Together with Matt Wardlaw is what we're calling this thing, and I'd like to thank everybody for checking out the first episode last week, which featured an interview with author Greg Renoff about his great new book, Van Halen Rising, How a Southern California Backyard Party Band Saved Heavy Metal. Say that 12 times fast. DX Ferris, who you might know from the Popdose universe as the guy who does the Suburban Metal Dad comic strip that runs on Popdose several times a week, join me for that interview. And I mentioned Ferris briefly in the podcast intro last week, but you should know, if you're not aware of this already, that he's the guy who wrote the essential overview of the Slayer album Rain and Blood for the 33 and a Third series, and he's also the responsible party who brought you the follow-up to that book called Slayer 66 and Two Thirds, The Jeff and Dave Years. Now, if you thought Greg's book title was long, Ferris's title for Slayer 66 and Two Thirds, that actually goes on a lot longer, but due to time constraints here on the podcast, we've edited that. You can read the full book title online and then email Ferris and tell him that he should have found the edit button for that title. Now, as I mentioned last week, Ferris was the guy who came to me and said, you've got to finish reading Greg's book so we can do a podcast with him about it. I want to do something early enough that we can get it out there in time for the holiday shopping season so that folks looking for a cool gift idea will hear it. Now, I've been plotting the idea of doing this podcast for a little while, but the nudge from Ferris suddenly presented me with a set of issues. I didn't have the pieces in place to get the podcast up and out to the world on relatively short notice, and obviously I wanted to have a website and a podcast logo and some fancy production and an iTunes feed so that people could subscribe to it and all that stuff, and I, of course, needed a name for the podcast. But I also have that spontaneous side that's not afraid to just go ahead and take the leap and fill in some of those gaps later. So I knew I had a way to record the podcast, and with Popdose, I knew I had a place to put it thanks to my good comrade Jeff Giles, who owns Popdose and has always generously given me and so many other folks a place to put my things. And then you're sitting there going, but Matt, you also have that website Addicted to Vinyl that you haven't done hardly anything with in ages, and all of that is very true as well. Now, since you're listening to this podcast, you're aware that obviously I went with the spontaneous feeling, and now here we are two podcasts into this thing, and the items that still need to be fleshed out, certainly we'll get those knocked out bit by bit. So in time, hopefully a short time, there will be an iTunes feed, and there will be a logo, and all that stuff. For now, you can find the podcast episodes archived over at popdose.com, and we have a Twitter feed at LostTogetherPod. Today's episode was actually recorded before the one that we did with Greg Renoff. On November 20th, I spoke with drummer Jason Bonham for a phone conversation from his Florida home, and at that point, he was getting ready for a short run of tour dates with his project Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin Experience, which began on December 4th in San Jose, and he's got about 2 weeks worth of shows that will be wrapping up on December 18th in Reading, Pennsylvania. He's going to be here in the Cleveland area this coming Sunday, December 13th, for a return visit to the Hard Rock Roxino after a sold-out show at that same venue in May, and I understand that tickets are going similarly fast for this show, so you're probably not going to want to wait to get tickets if you are planning to go. You can find a complete rundown of all the tour dates at facebook.com/Jason Bonham, or you can go directly to jasonbonham.net, where there is tour and ticket information and also info on VIP packages to meet Jason if that's something you're interested in. I have to send out thanks to my longtime comrade Todd Flinner at Live Nation, who reached out and asked me if I would be interested in speaking with Jason, and surprisingly, all the different things that Jason's been involved with in recent years, I haven't spoken with him. And of course, more recently, he has been involved with Sammy Hagar and The Circle, which is the all-star project featuring, of course, Mr. Hagar, bassist Michael Anthony, guitarist Vic Johnson, and Mr. Bonham on drums. And that project tours playing material from Sammy's solo career, his stuff with Montrose, Van Halen, and of course, Led Zeppelin tracks, thanks to Jason being on drums. So that's been a really cool project that I hope will make its way to the Cleveland area sometime here in the next year. But in the conversation that I had with Jason, he did indicate that Sammy is planning more of a full-scale tour with The Circle next summer. There'll be a more extended set of tour dates. And they do have a live DVD called At Your Service that's about to hit the streets, the video companion to the live album of the same name that came out within the past couple of months. So I was happy to take this interview because I knew there'd be a bunch of fun topics to dig into with him. And on the top of my list was asking him about his work with Phil Collins. Now, Phil, as you know, has been effectively retired from music due to wanting to spend more time with his family, and more than that, just the physical pain that had developed to the point that he was no longer able to play the drums. And last year, Phil spent about a month rehearsing with his band, which was an exciting revelation, and it's the lineup featuring a lot of the guys like Leland Sklar, who have played with him for years and years and years. And in the mix, behind the kit for those rehearsals, there was Jason Bonham. So we dig into that topic and a bunch of other stuff, and I think you'll enjoy listening to this interview. So before we get started, here's just a bit of information on Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin experience. As I mentioned, the band is heading back out on the road this December, so right now, with a string of 11 concerts to close out the year, and the show features the legendary blues rock of Led Zeppelin with hits from the iconic band's entire career, including Led Zeppelin, Led Zeppelin II, Led Zeppelin IV, Physical Graffiti, and lots more, including music from the latest reissues, Coda, In Through the Outdoor, Presence. It's a concert event that celebrates the life and music of Jason's father, the legendary Led Zeppelin drummer John Bonham, with, quote, a band that recreates Led Zeppelin's music to such a degree that one can't help but close their eyes and simply listen. That's what Classic Rock Revisited wrote after seeing the band. Jason Bonham, who famously filled in for his dad, the late John Bonham, said of the experience, it's part storyteller, with using the multimedia screens and things, we're creating little pieces, which I will narrate over, which gives a little background over some songs we play and the reason why I'm playing them. There's stories of myself growing up with dad and how Zeppelin has been, you know, a part of my life from the beginning. So there you have it. Let's get into my interview with Jason Bonham. Hope you guys enjoy it. Let's start at the top. You're a guy who always keeps busy doing something, and you're always up to plenty of things. What's got you out for this current run of tour dates with Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin experience?
Well, for me, this is kind of the a very fun part of what I do. I mean, to be able to go out and represent the family and play some of the greatest music that was ever written. When an opportunity comes up, when I knew that my regular gig with Sammy Hagar and the Circle with Michael Anthony and that was we just finished about last week, so I knew I had an opportunity in December, which generally we do, I would say, 25 to 30 shows a year, and that's it. So in the scheme of things, we managed to get, you know, a run of dates together. And Cleveland was so great to us in May when it was offered to the Hard Rock. They took it straight away. So it was a fun Zeppelin town. So, yeah, I mean, obviously there'll be some songs in the set list which will be the same, but there's, for me, since we played, there's been the final two albums that have been released, the remastered deluxe version. So I thought I'll change the set around a little bit and add, you know, even songs on Coda from Into the Outdoor, and just change it up a little bit, as I said, because there's so many great songs to play. So every time we go out, we try and keep it as fresh for ourselves as well as for the audience.
I had the pleasure of seeing you in the band a few years ago when you guys were out touring with Heart. Is this band the same lineup of guys that was out on that run?
Yes, it is. Yeah, we've actually been, as I say, when we look at things, we haven't worked that much in the 5 years. I mean, and when I look back and think, I was only going to do it once. And it's kind of grown, and the requests constantly come in. So yes, the same guys, as I said, we only see each other for about a month a year. That's about as much as we see each other. But we just have the same connection when it comes to Led Zeppelin music. Each one of them is as passionate about it. I always said, The rule to be in the band, you've got to love it as much as me, if not more. And because I'm not big into rehearsing, I like the fact that if they know the catalogue, like I know the catalogue, then it's great, because we all just go in for one day just pick the songs, play them, you know, once or twice, and then be ready to tour. So, I like to keep it as fresh as possible.
Was it hard getting the right lineup of guys together to do these songs justice?
Really, I knew the guitar player from 1996, but I've met him in 89. So when I kind of touched on this project in a kind of different form back in 96, but it took a long time to really to find the rest of the guys, that especially James the singer, who by accident I found him online. You know, it was somebody said, have you checked out this guy who does this virtual Zeppelin? And it was just uncanny. So when he came down, I flew him down to my house in Florida, and we got together. I wanted to see him sing it in real life. I mean, because, you know, he could be just lip syncing or miming. So it was, and it's funny. It was something that I played to a lot of people, and they were amazed. So yeah, he's a great find. You know, he doesn't do this professionally. He said to me, he said, that was it. I just did a bit of internet singing and on this website. You know, he said, I was in a band about 16 years ago, but that was before I had my kids. And then once the kids came along, he says, I kind of gave up. So he's only really got back into it, you know, 5 years ago. And so it's an amazing story for him, really. Like, this is just something he does. He's an artist. He's an amazing artist, actually. Some of his work is very cool. So for him to have this talent, to be able to come out and do this, you know, it was somebody said to him, you know, you sound a little bit like Robert Plant. And that was it, you know. It's a strange thing, you know, uncannily. On certain eras, periods of Zeppelin, he's very, very close to Robert. And then there's certain songs that he's not so. So I try and do the best songs we can for the band as well as for the fans. You know, I always say we do them to the best of our ability. If they can't be done to the top, you know, to the best, I'd rather not do it and do one that we do much better. You know, as I say, Zeppelin were, you know, an amazing thing and hard act to reproduce, really.
Since you're a guy who came up with the old school system, auditioning band members in the traditional sense, it has to be pretty cool for you where things have evolved to the way you can, you know, source and research band members using the internet and YouTube these days.
Yeah, well I'm very fortunate these days. It's everything is at the fingertips. You haven't got to go out and do like you used to when I first started to, you know, get into bands when I was 16, 17. You know, I would go down to London and you'd go around the clubs and you know, we'd go to the Marquee 6 days a week, seeing different rock acts that were playing. And if you liked somebody, you would try and poach them from that band. And so there was a lot of legwork done in those days. But today, you know, as you say, you just type in, you know, you can go through, you know, 100 or a million different singers or, you know, on certain specific music, you just type it in and look for the one you can. You know, Journey was a classic example in a big way when they found their guy. So it's an amazing thing now, the internet, really.
I want to go back and talk about doing the Heart Tour for a second. I mean, they're an enduring example of a band that came along not too long after Zeppelin, but Zeppelin certainly had been around long enough that they made significant impact with Ann and Nancy. And I mean, that's something you can still hear that influence in their music today.
I mean, when we got a chance to do the Kennedy Center Honors, when they told me what they were going to do, and it was like even top, you know, I couldn't tell them. I couldn't tell Robert. I couldn't tell Jimmy. I couldn't tell John Paul Jones. You know, I was under oath. When I was talking to the producers of the show, and they actually said to me, who do you think, because they were thinking at the time to get like Pink or, you know, a more of a modern day artist. And I said, to be honest, as much as I know, because Pink was at the O2 show, as much as I said that, I said, you know what, two people that would do this wonderfully, especially with the song, because one plays guitar and one sings is Anna Nancy. And they are huge Zeppelin fans, so they would probably just really just, you know, want to do it. So, and then the next thing you know, we were doing a tour just from that one meeting to play together, to honor them, you know, to honor Zeppelin. That led to a whole summer tour. So, yeah, I mean, it's amazing how that all worked out. And, it was crazy because the following year, the DVD came out, the O2 Arena, got a Grammy, which is like, you know, I can't imagine at this point of my career, you know, it to me, the last 10 years of my life have been the busiest and most successful times for me ever. So, who'd have thought it? Yeah, so never give up.
You and your dad, a lot of us with parents, I mean, obviously we have whatever photos and memories accumulated throughout the lifetime, but it doesn't go further than that. For you, you've had the benefit of being able to collect and peruse the various bootlegs that are out there. What's one of the favorite moments of his work that you've come across in that way?
There's always, for me, for years and years and years and years, I've never been, and I'll tell you this now, a buddy of mine, he has an absolute, basically every bootleg that's out there. But I can only listen to the ones that are really well recorded. Even if it's an amazing performance, but it's not very good quality, I'm not into it. It's funny, the sound is a huge part of it to me when I listen to it. So for years, you know, the song remains the same. Live version was the standard that I set everything to. And it kind of is the most familiar to everybody, you know, to the average guy or woman. The most significant live version of Zeppelin stuff is from the Song Remains the Same. So with that said, then they released How the West Was Won. And I've got to say, sonically as well, sound-wise, the drum solo in 72, I think even beat the solo in 73. And there's a great part in the, and if you haven't heard it for a while, put it back on, have a check it out. It came on randomly in my car the other day, just on when it was just on shuffle mode, and I had to pull the car over because it was so good, and it felt like I hadn't never heard it, and it was, you can almost hear my dad's brain start ticking in the middle of the solo. He suddenly like goes. He goes into like a snare pattern where it's basically like a holding pattern where he's thinking of what to do next. And it's a great moment where you actually can hear like the cobweb, the brain going, okay, what shall I do now? What shall I do now? Oh, yeah, okay. And he goes into another section. Excellent. But there's, I think the Seattle 77, if it was bootlegged, I have a video. So it's audio and visual of Seattle 77, which has a very, very cool drum solo where he actually used to use the intro to Out on the Tiles. It wasn't the Moby Dick riff. It was Out on the Tiles into the drum solo. So that's a pretty cool one. And that's a Seattle 77.
The feeling and the sound that he had as a player, that's something that obviously lives on with your drumming. What do you think is the most important thing that you learned from him that really was key to your own development as a player?
Something I still take to me every day, and when I play, is his ability. And yeah, I have to remind myself constantly his ability to be to take a breath before you start playing. His ability to be in the pocket and groove from the moment he starts live, you know, in a live concert. Because I always feel for the first three songs you're a bit, I always find I'm a bit tight. So you always utilize the first three songs to get into where you want to be, the groove you want to be in. So, but Dad seemed to be able to just, go out there, and from the moment he started, he was in the pocket, you know, and that's the biggest thing. It's not about chops for me, not about all that. It's at that groove, you know, playing where it doesn't sound tight. You're not on top of things. It's it's got to sit. And every now and again, when I'm working with Sammy, he comes up to me, and for a while, I kept thinking, what's he doing? Why is he coming up and standing next to me and putting his hands in his pocket? I didn't know what he was doing. It's like he was bored. And I was like, Sammy, what are you doing? It's kind of distracting. He said, that's the moment when you get the pocket, when you're really in the pocket. And I'm like, got it. So when he'd come and stand next to me and just like put his hands in his pocket, I'd go, what have I done? You know, are you pissed? He goes, no, that means you're really in the pocket right now.
You'd made a few records of your own by the time you ended up playing with Jimmy Page on the Outrider record. What was that experience like for you going in and doing that?
Playing with Jimmy, you know, for me, when I always look back at it now and wish I could redo over everything. You know, I've never been really. I don't think I'm. I think that's just when you strive to get better is you always think you could do better in every performance you played or recorded or captured or I wish we'd have rehearsed more for that or wish we'd have wish another take was used. But the experience was an amazing one, and I almost kind of blew it because I was very young at the time, and still kind of green around the edges, and I would push the boundaries because Jimmy was so close in family wise. So before we would start each day, I would nip out from Jimmy's studio at the time, the Soul, and run down to the local pub and have a few pints before we'd start. And then and one day I was specifically late, and I think that's particular late, and I got into the studio and then went in to make himself a sandwich, and he kind of lost his temper, and it freaked me out because I'd never seen that side of him before. So it was like I was really sad because I was scolded, by my uncle. So it suddenly felt very real that I was, that this is not just, this is real. This is, you've got to work now. This is, you're expected to be at places at the right time. So, yeah, it was, and I've continued to do that with Jimmy a few times, even down to the O2 rehearsals, no matter where I was staying, if I was 3 miles away or 100 miles away, I generally, in the week, I would generally be late three or four times, by 20 to 30 minutes. And always those guys, I couldn't believe that they were always there on time or even not early. And I'd walk in and they'd be sat reading a newspaper waiting for me to get there, which is just, when I look back now, it's actually a very, very fond memory of the three of them. I'd walk in and go, oh, okay, well, he's arrived. His Lordship's here.
I would imagine that a little bit later when you went and did the first Bonham record with Bob Ezrin, that probably gave you some additional opportunity to grow and develop further.
Oh, very much so. I mean, Bob Ezrin was a very, he didn't sugarcoat anything. So if you sucked or played badly, he had the greatest of pleasure of ripping you apart. I mean, really, and that was the great side of him. He didn't pardon the expression bullshit anybody. If you did a great performance, he was very, he was very up on it. He was very complimentary. If you did a bad performance, he was also, he wouldn't sugarcoat it, tell you that it sucked. And he gave you, but he would also give you constructive criticism. It wasn't like, that sucks, just do it again. He would kind of tell you where he wanted it to be, and I loved him for that. It was another big learning curve. To be there, but he did let me. One of the main things was it was always like to push me to play more. Like to not hold back, really go for it. And he goes, and if it doesn't work out, we'll do another take. But don't try and suppress, what you want to do just because the red light's on. In actual fact, I think he took all the red lights out of the studio. So none of us would ever get that fever, that red light fever. A lot of fun. That was another great time in my life. And then Bob was really a huge part of putting that band together, because I went to LA with another singer And Bob came in the room and he just walked out and said, "Can I talk to you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "That guy's not the right guy." He goes, "And don't worry, I'm going to go and tell him now." And before we knew it, Bob had walked into the room and said, "Buddy, I'm sorry, but it's not going to work out with you singing." Now, for me at the time, we'd spent, you know, about a year trying to find a singer at that point. And so, yeah, he really was a part of the whole putting it together. And he was the one who listened to Danny. We found somebody sent us a demo of Daniel McMaster, who eventually became the singer, you know, singing live in this bar doing, you know, covers. And he said, "That's your guy. So go and find out where he is and get him, bring him back." And we did. He was in Barrie, Ontario, and the manager flew up there and saw him play. And then the next thing you know, he was in LA with us, and we started recording.
So you end up having the first radio success of your own with that record, and you know, with the song, the single, obviously, "Wait for You." How'd that feel?
That was really the first time that I started writing, also, and "Wait for You" came about was. I won't go into the full detail, but I was rehearsing with Jimmy for the Outrider tour, and the keyboards were set up, and I stayed behind in the room and started messing around on the keyboards and came up with the chorus chords to "Wait for You," and then made a cassette of it, sent it to my guitarist and bass player, keyboard player, John Smithson and Ian Hunt, and then we put the rest of it together. So we thought that was going to be an instrumental track from the moment we started doing it. I mean, down to the intro with the big long, you know, everything about it. And Ezrin said, no. And when Danny started singing what he did, I remember saying to him, think like you too, think like "With or Without You." And he came up with "Wait for You." And that was, That was a fun time. It was just nice to come up with that.
Last year, you got the chance to work with Phil Collins, and I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about that experience.
For me, working with them, when I got the call about a year before, I actually got it on Thanksgiving 2013. On Thanksgiving Day, Tony, his manager, called me. And I was like, "Hello," you know. So it was a nerve-wracking thing. But when we finally, you know, schedules and everything, we got together. I mean, I was hugely nervous. But as usual, I was late. even though it was just down the street for me. Strangest of things, my tech calls me and says, "How far away are you?" And I said, "Why?" I said, "Phil's not due in till 1:00. He goes, "No, he came in early to see you." And I'm like, "Oh, my God." So I get there and Phil's like, "Really? Is this how it's going to be?" So I said, "Don't worry. I'm late for every artist I work with. Don't feel special." But it was, just an amazing thing. I mean, Phil really was one of my big heroes when I was young after Dad passed away. I mean, I was like a puppy dog following him around in for a couple of years. It was, I think, the first ever solo tour he did after the second solo album, "Hello, I Must Be Going." I went around and you know, I was 17. I just got my driver's license and I followed him around for a few shows in England. You know, got to sit on his kit and play back then. So it was a full circle, you know, to do it again and play with, to be the new guy in a room full of all the musicians that have played with him for years and years and years, you know, to look over and, I mean, Daryl Sturmer is just phenomenal. The player, his sound, he was, you know, right on, you know, Leyland Sklar. Absolute phenomenal to do it. And for 3 weeks, you know, to do that many songs, absolutely crazy, because I can't read music. So, you know, if they needed to read a chart, they could. I had to learn everything. So a lot of fun to play. I mean, I don't know what will come of it. There's been a lot of hype on the internet. I'm not sure what's been going on, but I would be honored to take it further into a public situation.
Like your dad, Phil obviously has a very distinctive sound when you hear him playing. I mean, you know who that is. And I would think that that would have to have been interesting for you as a player going in to do that, and maybe even a little bit intimidating. So I wondered, how did you approach it?
Well, as I said, something that I was very into. So I get to, you know, I choose, for me, it's like the tools you need for each job. I don't stick to the same drum setup when I go and play with Sammy. I don't, you know, I have a different setup. I listen to the music and what is needed, you know. So obviously with Phil, you know, I get to bring out the bigger kit with more toms and a, you know, slightly different cymbal setup. So it is, it's a whole different approach. Drum head wise, I use different heads. Yeah, I mean, I really do take it to that, you know, to that level where I, you know, I'm really into every fine, you know, detail, even microphones for certain, you know, for the drums. Kick drum, I go down to a 23. It's, yeah, everything has to change when you're playing with different people, because obviously you listen. It is so distinctive, his drum sound. And to me, I was like, I want it to sound more like Phil than Chester. So I wanted it to sound like the album more than anything else. So even down to effects and different things, I would in the room just to get it as close as I could. So yeah, it's a very it's a huge thing. And you know, if it never went any further than that, I still got a chance to play with it and do In the Air Tonight together, which was that would stay with me forever.
I want to go back to what you've got going on right now that we talked about at the front of things, which that being Jason Bonham's Led Zeppelin experience. And I wondered, have the Zeppelin guys, have they had a chance to see this?
Not in real life, not at the moment. I'm sure they have. I'm sure they've clicked on I'm sure they've seen a clip or so. I would love to, you know, I'd love to have them come out to a show. There's something I do, and I'm trying to keep doing, you know, we'll do it on a regular basis in at the Greek in LA. Excuse me. The Greek in LA around Dad's birthday. And we did it on Dad's birthday this year, and it was amazing. And Robert was playing 2 days later at the Greek. And I rang him to see if he would come down, but he got a gig at Santa Barbara on that day. But that'd be something for me. I think that just to get one of them to come out and get up and have a play, because it really is a celebration of the music. For why I do this is for the love, and it is a time where you can just we go out and play, you know, to our best ability and to some of the greatest songs ever. And you know, sometimes the reasons why we go out and do it in different stages and with different set lists. Because we just love playing, you know, there's all those different songs. So definitely be expecting to hear, every album will be represented on these shows. But, you know, I'm not going to steer clear of, you know, I want to make sure that at least Coda's in represented Into the Outdoor, you know, Fool in the Rain, things like that. Tracks like Wearing and Tearing from Coda, you know, Presence, things like Hots for Nowhere. To me, that is the main thing.
What else is on deck for you as we look towards the new year?
I've got some more shows. We've got a DVD coming out with Sammy and the Circle, which comes out, I believe. There's going to be some Access. It's going to be on Access TV, and also Sammy's got a TV show, I believe, that's going to be being worked on. And then we're going to go out in the summer, I believe, with Sammy and do some more shows. You know, in a more of a block, instead of doing a few each month, we're going to actually do it as a full on tour. And then I'm possibly going to go out again with JBLZ while I've got the chance, while Sammy's not going to be doing anything. And hopefully in April and May. So and try and get another 20 shows in before I have to shut it down again for the year.
It seems like it's an enjoyable thing for you working with Sammy Hagar. And I talked to Sammy earlier this fall. I mean, he talked about how excited he is to get in the studio with you guys. He told me about one of the songs that he was calling Wide Open Space at that point.
It is. I mean, I've known Sammy for a long, long time. And I kind of wanted to work with him many, many years ago, but you know, everything happens for a reason. And you know, when you get to a certain point in your career, that it's, you know, it's meant to be. And musically, yeah, I mean, actually, I did the drums for that song, Wide Open Space, when I was in back at Sammy's about a month ago. So yeah, that's well on its way for being done. So yeah, a lot of fun.
2007, you finally got the chance to play a full show with John Paul Jones, Jimmy, and Robert, and that had to be a pretty cool thing for you.
Oh, I mean, that was to do it the way we did it, because with that it was I wanted to rehearse. we rehearsed and we rehearsed and we rehearsed. And, it was a great experience, not only as the show, but just to get to know them. You know, now I'm older, much, much older than I was when this little kid running around the studio, and to talk to them, and you know, occasionally just to share music. I'd give Jimmy a ride home and I'd play music in the car and see what he thought of different bits of music that I was listening to, and either turn him on to something or he'd turn me on to something and say, oh, play so and so, have you heard them yet? Same with Robert. I would go out with Robert, we'd go out locally when I was back home. So yeah, it was to go out to an Indian restaurant with those three guys, and be sat there, and nobody really knew what we were talking about. And at the time, we were talking about, you know, doing the Zeppelin reunion show at the O2. It was surreal, to say the least. It was sat there, I'm going, oh my God, this is really going to happen. And from the moment we started, it was a special show. I knew once we got past the first three songs, I would say, once we kicked into In My Time of Dying, I felt it was very, very special. It kind of got better and better. So I'm, you know, very blessed.
What else do you want folks to know about?
As I say, yeah, just check out The Circle. You know, that's the other things I have been doing with the live disc. Also, as I said, yeah, just keep following on the Facebook, Twitters. I thank everyone for their support. It's if it's going to be like it normally is, it will be a great show. Cleveland always seems to sell out faster than anywhere else, and of course I get to say hello, Cleveland.